All right. Well, as so it's very exciting to have Will to tell us about these final results from Boss. We have a rather larger than usual crowd, so the excitement is general. So Will, take it away.
Thank you. I'll do my best to dampen down that level of excitement. So I'm going to tell you about the final cosmology results from the SDSS, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. EBOSS represents the last survey that SDSS will do in terms of a galaxy redshift survey. The Sloan Telescope will carry on and do different things. We arranged, and it actually worked, to have 23 papers out last Monday, week last Monday. And I was heavily involved in the coordination of them. I was and still am for a few more months the EBOSS survey scientist, which meant I was one of a management team of three people who were putting this all together. I was just looking back in terms of putting this seminar together, and I started work on EBOSS issues back, I think, 8 years ago. We started to put together the proposal for the collaboration. So this is the end of 8 years of work. Okay, so the SDSS is a collection of experiments that have taken place over the last 20 years, all of them using the Sloan Foundation Telescope. It wasn't originally called the Sloan Foundation Telescope, but when they kept funding SDSS, it was renamed after them. Top left is perhaps the most interesting photo that for those of you that have seen the SDSS telescope before. This is it as it originally was. This is the first light image. And it was quite a radical design of telescope. They originally designed it not to have a dome and to sit out on this plinth, but be open to the atmosphere. It was one of these conceptual ideas that would have saved money, and it was thought to be good, and it turned out to be completely wrong. And they actually needed a conventional dome, particularly to stop wind shake and to stop issues to do with background light coming into the camera. So they built, bottom left, this construction around it that serves the purpose of a conventional dome. This aluminium structure is isolated mechanically from the telescope. So if the wind shakes this, it doesn't shake the telescope. And this improved the seeing and the conditions a great deal. So the Sloan Telescope is a relatively small telescope. It's a 2.5 meter diameter primary mirror. The key thing is that on the back end, there's this multi-object spectrograph, the best in the world in terms of getting spectra for a large number of objects over a wide field of view. So this shot in the middle here is of the telescope pointed horizontally. And you see at the back end, these two green structures are the multi-object spectrographs. Each one can take the light input from 500 fibers placed on the focal plane at the known positions of galaxies, take that light in, disperse it onto a detector, and then measure the spectrum of the galaxy. So to get the light, pick the light off at known locations of galaxies when the telescope is pointed at a particular patch on the sky, we use these aluminium plates. These aluminium plates are just over a meter across. They have 1,000 holes drilled in at the precise locations of where we expect targets to be. Into each of these holes is plugged a fiber optic cable. That fiber feeds the light, 500 in one direction, 500 in the other, such that when that plate is positioned at the focal plane of the telescope, it can take the light off from one observation. Each observation takes about an hour of time. So in a good night in the winter, you can observe eight of these plates, with the observer coming out in the middle of the night and changing the plates over within their cartridges using this trolley system. So in a good night, we get 8,000 spectra, which we then basically use to build up a map of the universe. So the SDSS Large Scale Structured Galaxy Surveys. Started from the start of the telescope just after first light. SDSS 1-2, over the first 10 years, they gave us the main galaxy sample, lots of bright galaxies at low redshift, and then some luminous red galaxies, which were actually subsumed into later surveys. So really from the first 10 years of the SDSS, we now have a main galaxy sample. We know what's happening in the local universe out to redshifts of 0.2. In 2009, the instrument was upgraded. New detectors, detector technology had moved on a great deal, but it used the same fiber pickoff. The fibers were improved as well, actually, but the same design in terms of having the plate and the spectrographs themselves either side. And SDSS-3 then launched the BOSS experiment, Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey, which mainly observed luminous red galaxies and also quasars for Lyman Alpha Forest measurements. The luminous red galaxies took us out to redshifts of 0.7, and then the quasars looked at the patch around a redshift of 0.22. And then, as I say, 8 years ago, we launched the EBOS experiment, now part of SDSS-4, and this observed luminous red galaxies, emission line galaxies, quasars as direct tracers, and quasars of the Lyman Alpha Forest. Again, more of them from BOSS. So basically, we went further out in redshift than BOSS, but with slightly less dense samples. And we basically filled in this evolutionary sequence where we made cosmological measurements over a whole series of different redshifts. So it's been kind of difficult to describe the final BOSS result, sorry, the final EBOS results, but it's also coincident with the end of SDSS, Large-Scale Structured Galaxy Surveys, and EBOS, kind of like we said in the press release, it fills in the gap. It gives us that whole range of cosmological evolution all the way from the local universe redshifts less than 0.2 out to redshifts of 2.2. So what we've kind of had is a joint celebration, both of EBOS announcing its results and the end of SDSS doing its Large-Scale Structure Galaxy Surveys. Okay. So if you want more information and the details and links, there is some very good websites that were put together. The lead was Carl Dawson took the lead of putting these together. This one, the link at the bottom of this screen, it includes, for example, this table. This table includes all of the details of all of the different galaxy survey measurements and experiments that have been done under the SDSS umbrella, giving you the redshift ranges, number of galaxies, effective redshifts, and, you, and the references where you can go away and get more information about the catalogs. All of these catalogs are publicly available. You can go away and download them all. This is one of the things I think SDSS has done really, really well. We spent a lot of time and effort making the data reductions public, making them well documented, and making them accessible. And this has paid off in terms of other people using them. Okay, right. Hopefully this starts playing. As part of the press release, we put together a whole series of different videos. This is one of them highlighting the different surveys in the sphere of the observable universe. The yellow is the main galaxies observed in SDSS 1 and 2. The pink going further out are the BOSS galaxies. And then extending out in this blue region is the EBOS ELGs. The light blue are, the light blue are the EBOS ELGs. These are the quasars. And then as you get to the end of it, you see the Lyman Alpha Forest measurements. So this is how it all fits together. This is how the map basically shows us a three-dimensional map of the universe. Okay, everybody good? Right. Okay, so as I said, SDSS-5 will not perform a large-scale structure redshift survey, so it's the end of the era. I think we went out with a bang. 23 papers on the archive last Monday. We dominated the archive. We made 4 promotional videos, 2 of them with the help from PI. One of the PI ones now has about 300,000 hits on YouTube. So it's giving the information to the world. The press releases, the local variations around the world. There were many articles in newspapers. Some were actually accurate and well-written, which was pleasing. And there we go, end of the era. Okay. So the rest of the seminar is a hastily put together review of EBOS and those 23 papers. So
Sorry, can you go on? What is going to be SDSS 5?
There is going to be an SDSS 5. It is not going to do a Galaxy Redshift survey. It's going to concentrate on the nearby, studies within our galaxy, concentrating on focused black hole clusters of galaxies and that kind of project.
Okay, thank you.
The reason is really that SDSS, the Sloan Telescope, cannot compete with DESI in terms of this type of galaxy redshift survey. DESI is a factor of 20 times faster than SDSS. Mm-hmm. So SDSS has to go off and do different things.
Makes sense. Thanks.
Okay. All right, so 23 papers to get through. I've got to go reasonably quickly, so interrupt me if you have questions. We're going to start off with the catalogs and tests. So the big thing when you've measured a whole tranche of galaxy redshifts is not just putting them together in a file, it's actually understanding where you could have observed redshifts. So you don't observe a nice isotropic homogeneous region in the universe, in sampling of the universe. I mean, what you observe is a particular patch of the sky. Some patches are deeper than others. Some catches have different fluctuations. And you have to take all of that information and use that information when you measure the cosmological clustering. So this plot top left shows the sky imprint of the EBOS surveys. Actually, the gray points, they are BOSS galaxies, so the previous generation, and then all of the other colors are EBOS. The yellow colors are the luminous red galaxies and quasars. That was the area that they were observed on. The purpley blue is the emission line galaxies. They were performed basically as a completely different survey over a smaller area, but going higher out further in redshift and deeper. The plot bottom left shows the redshift distributions. You can see how the BOSS CMAS galaxies, the BOSS galaxies, were relatively low redshift. Then with EBOSS, we went out in redshift with the luminous red galaxies shown in red, the emission line galaxies in purple, and particularly the quasars here, where we observed many quasars out at redshift around 1.5. There are a lot of nuances with the catalogs. For example, this plot shows that each fiber itself had a different probability of giving rise to a galaxy with a good redshift. So if, for example, you placed fiber 500 on a galaxy, you would only have a 92% probability of measuring a redshift accurately for that galaxy. But if you placed fiber 650 on a galaxy, then you have a 96% probability. And these fluctuations are obviously artificial. They're put in by the way in which you do the survey, and you want to try and remove them to get a good survey. So we do an inverse weighting to remove this. There are other effects as well. And this paper here by Ashley Ross, led by Ashley Ross, tells you all of the nitty-gritty details of how the observations turned out. For example, the number of targets that we observed thinking they were luminous red galaxies, but that turned out to be stars or turned out to be quasars. How many we couldn't get because there was another fiber too close. How many just failed to get a redshift because the spectra were too noisy. All of this needs to be catalogued, carefully considered, and turned into information that we use to create what we call the large-scale structure clustering catalogue. The same was done for the emission line galaxies. In fact, the emission line galaxy sample was a major headache for the team. That's because we targeted from data that had significant fluctuations in the depth. So actually, the Sloan Telescope only gets the spectra and the redshift. We need to know where to put the fibers. So we need to select a target sample from imaging data. The imaging data that we actually used for the emission line galaxies had significant fluctuations in it in terms of depth. They led through to significant fluctuations in the catalog that we end up with. There were other issues as well. This little inset here shows a blow up of one patch of the sky that we were observing. The different colored regions show parts of the sky that we couldn't observe for various reasons. Some of the regions didn't have the imaging data with the required colors and depths. Some of them we actually made mistakes on, this XY bug is a mistake where RA and DEC were actually flipped when we tried to put up a mask into the catalog. There were bright stars, we couldn't observe galaxies behind, and so on. And so basically there's a really intricate pattern imprinted on the sky by the observations that we want to remove when we get through to cosmological measurements. One of the problems we faced, this plot bottom right shows this problem. It shows the distribution in redshift that we get as a function of the depth of the imaging data. And what it actually shows is where the imaging data is deeper, we see fewer and fewer low redshift galaxies. And obviously we need to model this and take this out in order to understand that this isn't a cosmological fluctuation, but it's just a fluctuation led by the quality of the imaging data. So this is all explained in great detail in this paper here by Anand. Because of the difficulty of the ELG target selection, a group of people put together a plan for trying to understand the fluctuations. And what they did was they took the imaging data and they put in fake galaxies, and then they saw if those fake galaxies were observed as targets for the ELG sample or not. They used software called Obi-Wan to do this injection of fake galaxies into the sample, and then they basically took those galaxies out and tried to understand the distribution of targets that we're observing just from basically the signals and noise variations in the imaging data. And this is described in this paper. Within SDSS, there is a history of producing a quasar catalog. This isn't a large-scale structuring catalog, so it's not a catalog that's designed where you understand where you have or haven't observed objects. Instead, it's just a list of all of the quasars known in the universe. So people that go away and study quasars as individual objects have a reference catalog. As you can see from this plot, this is the date compared to the number of quasars known in the universe. And you can see that it's grown rapidly, particularly driven by these SDSS surveys and particularly by EBOS. As I say, we were filling in this gap between redshift 1 and 2 quasars. One of the other problems with quasars is actually measuring their redshifts. Because quasars, the light is coming from outflow from the black hole. The redshift measurement is complicated because the outflow velocities can contribute to the redshift, basically the line widths. They can give you asymmetric lines. They can change the positions of lines relative to each other, all making the redshift more difficult to measure. So this paper goes into some detail about the different redshift measurements, how they compare, what the most robust way is to measure a quasar redshift given a spectrum. And the final paper I want to talk about in this discussion of the catalogs is the one that Faizan here in Waterloo wrote. What he did was he took the assignment algorithm that takes a target sample and assigns fibers to those objects, and he reran it many times to work out the probability that each pair could be observed. Then he used this probability to remove these issues with the placement of the fibers from the clustering measurements. And he was able to recover clustering measurements here, the projected correlation functions, which were accurate on very small scales, where there are traditionally problems, particularly with not being able to put two fibers close enough together on the focal plane. Okay, any questions on the catalogs or the data that we've taken and released? Okay, just as I say, just shout out if you have questions. Right, so the next series of papers, they deal with creating mock catalogs. So it's very useful for testing your analysis algorithm to be able to have mock catalogs. In fact, what we had to have was mock catalogs that included all of the target samples. So they included quasars, luminous red galaxies, and emission line galaxies, all in the same mock catalogs. Rather than base them on N-body simulations, because of the time it would have taken and the volume and sampling required. Instead, we used approximate mocks, because the main thing we were worried about was once we had a something that looked like the universe, putting in all of the artifacts of the observations into that, making it look as close as possible to the actual EBOS data. And this paper here describes that creation, the creation of 1,000 mocks, each of them looking as close to EBOS as we can manage. So for example, it includes the small scale angular mask, all of these problems with the ELGs are there imprinted on the mocks. Now, turning to the analysis, the cosmological analysis, there are many different ways to analyze data and go from a correlation function or a power spectrum to cosmological measurements. And what we wanted to do was to make sure that we could robustly recover input cosmological parameters into mocks. And so we ran a series of mock challenges where a group created mock samples. They didn't tell anybody else what the cosmological parameters were. And then people had to go away and fit the data and check that they could recover the unknown cosmological parameters. And so in a series of papers, they go away and do that. In fact, this paper for the LRG mock challenge, it focused mainly on the small scale HOD used to populate a simulation called the outer rim simulation, and check that for different HODs, people could recover cosmological parameters correctly. We did the same thing for quasar sample, again, checking that different groups, different ways of doing the analysis could recover the right cosmological parameters. This is using both different cosmologies and different HODs. And you see the cosmological parameters are varying significantly, but most of the measurements come within the errors of the expected values.
What's an HOD?
Halo occupation distribution. It's the way in which you go from dark matter halos found in a simulation to populate them with galaxies.
Thanks.
Okay. And the same thing for the ELGs as well. And finally, for the ELGs as well, there was a paper looking at, particularly looking at the HOD and testing what the HOD is for emission line galaxies. Emission line galaxies actually track the universe in a way that's very different from samples that we've previously looked at, particularly luminous red galaxies, which tend to be central galaxies within halos. Emission line galaxies, there's a far greater fraction of satellite galaxies. Okay, so that's mock catalogs. Now moving on to the cosmological measurements. So the key measurement that we make is through baryon acoustic oscillations. Just to recap, baryon acoustic oscillations are in effect a standard ruler in one of these galaxy samples. If we look at the correlation function, you can think of this as just telling you the number of pairs of a given separation. We find there are way more galaxy pairs at a separation of about 100 h to the minus 1 megaparsecs than there are pairs at a separation of 125 megaparsecs or 75 megaparsecs. And this gives us a standard ruler in each of the samples. Formally, what's happening is that along the line of sight, the standard ruler is constrained by the co-moving sound horizon at recombination, RD. And this is a co-moving standard ruler. So when we measure the size of the standard ruler in terms of a redshift difference, we're sensitive to, basically because it's small, the standard ruler is small compared to cosmological distances, we're sensitive to dd over dz, which means we're sensitive to the Hubble parameter. And then the angular direction, we measure the standard ruler in terms of angular separation of pairs of galaxies, and we compare that to the co-moving sound horizon in co-moving physical units, and that means we're sensitive to the angular diameter distance. So this standard ruler, the baryon acoustic oscillation standard ruler, gives you slightly different information along and across the line of sight. And matching The size along and across the line of sight is called the Alcott-Pachinsky effect. It basically says that even if you didn't know how big your standard ruler was, and in terms of BAO, that means you don't know what the co-moving sound horizon at recombination was, just by making sure it's the same along and across the line of sight, you're sensitive to DA times H, this parameter combination. And this Alcott-Pachinsky effect can obviously be used for other things other than the BAO, but it does form a significant part of modern BAO measurements. Okay, so I'm now going to step through the different samples showing the BAO. On the left is a plot showing the baryonic acoustic oscillation signal in the correlation function. You can think of this as being the number of pairs of galaxies of different separation. And then on the right is the power spectrum, which is just the Fourier transform of the correlation function. Any feature in the correlation function, like a bump, the BAO bump, becomes a series of oscillations in the power spectrum. And so the inset in these plots shows those oscillations. So this is the main galaxy sample at low redshift. Here it's limited by the volume of the sample, but we still have a BAO detection. But it's really the BOSS sample where we had 600,000 galaxies between a redshift of 0.2 and 0.5 that we saw an incredibly strong BAO signal, both in the correlation function and the power spectrum. The higher redshift BOSS bin, 0.4 to 0.6, also shows a really high signal-to-noise BAO detection. EBOSS luminous red galaxies coupled with a tail of luminous red galaxies from BOSS out at a redshift of 0.6 to 1 also give us a good strong BAO detection, both in the correlation function and the power spectrum. The emission line galaxies have, it's a weaker detection, let me put it like that. There is still constraining power in these data. It's difficult to see by eye. It's not as significant. There is a significant...
sigma, is this weaker detection?
I was just talking through this slide, wishing I knew what the sigma was. I think it's 1 to 2 sigma, between 1 and 2.
Thanks.
The EBOSS quasars is more significant. And then as we go to the Lyman Alpha Forest, so the previous plots have been using these galaxies as traces, direct traces of the density field. With the Lyman Alpha Forest, we instead use the absorption features in the spectrum of distant quasars to understand the structure that's giving rise to those absorption features. It's a slightly more complicated analysis that you have to do, but there's a strong, as well, BAO detection. And you can get this BAO both by having the autocorrelation of the Lyman Alpha Forest, so that's looking at pairs of absorbers, so where you've got one absorber in one quasar and another absorber in the same spectrum, one absorber in the spectrum to one quasar and another absorber also within that spectrum. But then you can also look for cross-correlation between the Lyman Alpha Forest absorption features and other quasars surrounding it, and you can see the BAO signal in both of those. So all taken all together, what we've built up is in effect a BAO distance ladder. We have these BAO measurements at a series of redshifts now, and we can basically look at the distance as a function of redshift, and this plot shows that it all agrees with flat lambda CDM as predicted by the Planck 2018 CMB measurements. Okay, so looking at the cosmological information that we get from the BAO in more detail, here's the...
Can I interrupt you for another second? Sorry. So this thing with the, this kind of a slight tension that there was for Lyman alpha BAO at redshift of 2 or so, I mean, is that basically less so, or what is happening?
Yeah. It's slightly less so. There's still a slight tension there, but it's less significant than it was. And the result, the error bars have come down and the result has moved towards the Planck value.
I see.
As well as the tension going down. So, I mean, if you take this set of measurements as an ensemble population, there's no evidence that any one of them is an outlier. They all have the right distribution of being however many sigma they are away from the truth.
Okay. Thanks.
And is it just my imagination, or it kind of looks like in a number of these bins that the points near the peak are quite systematically are quite high above the best fit curve? Is that I guess at redshift 2, the purple and green plots here, and maybe slightly in the blue one. That's all a good. But anyway, it's all a good fit. There's no evidence for a bad fit to the BAR.
No evidence for a bad fit. I think your eye is quite good, having been given a model that has a peak of seeing data above it. There is, for example, data in the ELGs below the peak as well.
Okay.
I know there are some people who are interested in, could there be a way in which, if you have this kind of pattern, galaxies have a tendency to have a larger than expected peak, but I haven't yet seen a convincing explanation of any reason why that would be.
Okay.
So the peak is peakier in a lot of these, actually, slightly peakier. But also, are the different bins correlated? How correlated are they? Because they look a bit correlated.
So the y-axis, which is not plotted here, is different for all of them. So the model has a consistent baryon fraction, so it will have a consistent peak in the correlation function in terms of amplitude. So there's no evidence that the baryon fraction in changes with redshift in a way that isn't expected. The data are correlated with each other, yes. And that is taken into account in the fits. Okay. So this is the standard lambda detection plot. As I'm sure you've all seen before, this is what we call open lambda CDM cosmologies, where we allow for the universe not being flat, but we have a lambda CDM model. The dashed line obviously tells us flat universes. This gray area is the Planck CMB predictions. The red are the latest supernova results, and the blue are these SDSS BAO measurements. So you can see we're at a stage now where the BAO measurements themselves are give significantly tighter constraints in this space than the supernova results. And just with the BAO measurements alone, there is now an 8 sigma confidence detection of lambda in terms of 8 sigma detection of acceleration. The low redshift and the high redshift Baryonicus oscillations actually give you different information because of the degeneracies and the way that the model works. A lot of this constraint comes from the fact that you have both low and high redshift BAO, and this really tightens up the constraint in this space that I showed before. So the red here are the BAO measurements without the Lyman Alpha Forest, so just from the galaxies, and without the quasars. Without the high redshift quasars or Lyman Alpha Forest. And then the blue show that if you bring in these high redshift data from EBOS, you tighten up these constraints and pull yourself back to flat lambda CDM. And the same is true if you allow for the cosmology to vary, for example, letting the dark energy equation of state vary away from lambda, then you find that this combination of measurements at high and low redshift will pull you back to lambda and give you far greater constraining power than a single BAO measurement at a single redshift. One thing that you really need the BAO for when you have add it to the CMB data is that when you do allow a model to vary away from flatness, then you need the BAO data to pull you back to flatness. So this is the same set of models now with omega m and curvature. You can see the standard degeneracy that you get with the CMB, the geometrical degeneracy, and you see that you need low redshift data to break this degeneracy, and the BAO are just far stronger at breaking the degeneracy than the supernova data. This is the plot of H0 now. The BAO are not by themselves a standard ruler. They don't constrain the length of the standard ruler. They can use the co-moving sound horizon of recombination as the standard ruler, but they don't tell you what that co-moving sound horizon is. So in that way, you can't just from BAO get an absolute measurement of the Hubble parameter. You can only get relative measurements of the Hubble parameter as a series of as a function of redshift. So BAO, you can think of as they're allowing you to extrapolate from high and low redshift. So these plots, they show on the left, they show the Hubble parameter against the co-moving sound horizon at recombination. The distance ladder constraints, the Riesertal absolute distance measurements, they obviously predict H0 of around 74, whereas the Planck predicts H0 of around 68. If you bring in the BAO, which is shown by this line here, as I say, they are not by themselves an absolute measurement, so they don't constrain H0, they constrain this combination of H0 and the co-moving sound horizon. So if you combine them with the CMB, or you combine them with the distance ladder, or you combine them with Big Bang nuclear synthesis, then you choose between basically these two regions here in H0 space. So BAO plus BBN take you down to this low value. Basically, what we're saying is that BBN is completely consistent with the CMB, and the BAO are completely consistent with a lambda CDM evolution from the CMB, from the last scattering surface through to present day. So if you combine the BAO with either BBN or the CMB constraining you at high redshift, then you come back to this low value of H0 because you come back to flat lambda CDM. If, however, you normalize your BAO at very low redshift with the distance ladder constraints on H0, then your BAO are completely consistent with a higher value of H0, but then would predict a different co-moving sound horizon from the one you get from the CMB. And a lot of that is also tied to Omicron. Yeah, question.
Sorry, so what BBN data do you use?
Offhand, I could not tell you. The link will be in this paper. We will have just taken what is the most recent standard measure, basically of the baryon fraction that then lets you get the co-moving sound horizon of recombination.
Okay. I mean, usually that would be like deuterium and helium. Which from that you measure the baryon fraction. So you use just baryon fraction, is it right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
And Will, so there were these. I don't know if you were at this talk a few weeks ago by Levon Pogosyan about arguing that if you move the co-moving, that if you move recombination a little bit earlier, resolves the tension between supernova and the CMB. Does that same shift resolve the tension with here? Or
yes, uh-huh. It's the same thing. Basically.
So he was saying something in his talk that I didn't understand. That it's that using that technique, it's hard to satisfy both the CMB and the BAO constraints. Do you know what he meant about that?
No, I don't, because when you change RD, you change both the CMB and the large-scale structure in the same way.
Yeah.
And if the universe currently looks like flat lambda CDM in terms of its evolution from CMB to low redshift, and it stays as flat lambda CDM just with a different normalization, that all works through.
Yeah, okay.
But it might change different things in the CMB besides just, you know, the acoustic oscillations, right? So it might also maybe change like the damping tail or something.
Perhaps. Oh, yeah, true. So you mean, yeah. Mm.
Okay, so the next measurement we make as well as BAO is redshift space distortions. The general idea here is that our redshifts that we measure for these galaxies, they're a combination of the Hubble expansion rate with the growth of structure. The growth of structure changes the observed map that we see, and it changes it in a different way along and across the line of sight. So along the line of sight, we have these retrospace distortions. The retrospace distortions don't change the angular positions of the galaxies. So in terms of the clustering signal, it gives us a quadrupole component. So here's a plot of the amplitude of the correlation function as a function of the separation of the galaxies along the line of sight and across the line of sight. And you see this anisotropic pattern where you see this squashing. And this is basically what you're seeing is the growth of structure. We go away and measure the amount of this squashing. We can measure the structure growth rate and again get cosmological information out. Rather than trying to fit the full 2D likelihood contour of the correlation function split across and along the line of sight, we instead fit moments of this function, and basically the retrospace distortions give you a non-zero quadrupole. That is, you see a clustering signal that is stronger along the line of sight compared to across the line of sight in the power spectrum that you measure. So I've just got a series of plots now for each of the SCSS surveys going through in redshift, looking at this quadrupole. On the left is the correlation function, on the right is the power spectrum, which unfortunately we don't have for the main galaxy sample. And these are the 2D contours of the correlation function. And so you see, basically, we see a non-zero quadrupole in each of these samples. We fit it with a model, which then gives us the strength of the RSD signal through each of the samples. And then here's the distance ladder, if you like, plot. We don't call it a distance ladder, but it's the retrospace distortion measurements from SDSS compared to the predicted structure growth from flat lambda CDM cosmology as observed by Planck. And so you can see that all of our results are consistent with the structure growth predicted within the flat lambda CDM universe as normalized at higher redshift with the Planck data. So we can try to go away and just use the RSD, the retrospace distortion measurements, to also tell us something about the accelerated expansion of the universe. In fact, the RSD measurements aren't as powerful as the BAO measurements, but they are still, they are not quite enough to break the CMB degeneracy. But if you bring in CMB lensing, weak lensing, as other growth measurements, then you can find just from growth itself that you go back towards a flat universe with a significant detection of acceleration. So the evidence for acceleration and the flat lambda CDM universe doesn't just come from the expansion rate of the universe, but also the rate at which structure is growing within it. What the RSD is quite good at doing using just the growth is to pull you back towards lambda as your dark energy component. So if you let W vary away from minus one, then the CMB gives you this degeneracy. But if you include the RSD, or indeed if you include CMB lensing, weak lensing, it pulls you back to lambda CDM. The other thing is the amplitude of the fluctuations, sigma 8. What we can say is that pretty much all of the measurements we have give you a consistent structure growth rate in the universe. So if we go from all of these different measurements of structure growth and we normalize each of them in terms of the amplitude of fluctuations at present day, then you find most of them, or all of them, are consistent, statistically consistent with sigma 8 of being around 0.8. So this is another powerful test of the lambda CDM model and structure growth within it, and it's saying that structure growth within lambda CDM also looks like flat lambda CDM model. We can go further. We can look at, go back to metric fluctuations, then RSD. They are only sensitive to time-like metric fluctuations, being basically just the growth of structure itself, whereas weak lensing and CMB lensing, they're sensitive to this combination of time-like and space-like metric fluctuations. We can use this to try and parameterize deviations from general relativity and then bring back all of the growth rate measurements and find that we pull back to GR. Okay. So the final cosmological information I want to talk about is what we get if we combine BAO and RSD. One thing we looked at were bounds on the combined the summed neutrino mass, which changes basically cosmology. What's particularly strong is the BAO breaking degeneracies within the CMB data to enhance the precision by which you can measure the summed neutrino mass from CMB data. This plot, these are normalized probabilities. This is the inverted hierarchy, space allowed by inverted hierarchy. This is space allowed within the normal hierarchy for the summed neutrino mass. This is forbidden space with positive neutrino mass, and this is obviously forbidden space with negative neutrino mass. But we include them here in this likelihood, but it's very useful to be able to fit a Gaussian shape to the likelihood in order to get constraints out. This table gives our 95% upper limits on the neutrino mass. This is only within the range of likelihood where we allow positive summed neutrino mass. So this is basically the upper limit where 95% of the area under the likelihood is basically beneath less than this value.
Sorry, I can't do that.
Sorry, I said something that my phone picked up on.
I think that's because there is a neutrino oscillations that doesn't let you go below 0.05.
Yes. Yes, that's maybe awesome. Siri on my phone was worried about that.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So what you should bear in mind is that a 2 sigma upper limit on the neutrino mass doesn't necessarily directly tie into a difference between inverted and normal hierarchy because of this disallowed region at low neutrino masses. There are a number of interesting things in this table. You can see that we're just about getting to around 0.1 EV, which is this border between inverted and normal hierarchies. But interestingly, we are dependent on which data set we include. So you'll see that including the weak lensing data from DES actually increases the upper limit. So the information gets worse by including new data, which is very strange. But what's happening is there's a slight tension in these data sets between the value of omega m that they prefer, and that's coming out and changing what the neutrino mass constraints are. Okay, any questions that don't come from Siri on my on neutrino mass? Okay. So what we also did was try to look at the role of SDSS in cosmology over the last decade. We took the DETF, Dark Energy Task Force, figure of merit, and their definition of what are stage 2, stage 3 experiments. Stage 2 are basically anything that happened before 2010, which means it was WMAP CMB, JLA supernova, and low redshift measurements from Sloan 2 of BAO. So at 2010, our knowledge of the universe was shown by these gray contours, and then BOSS and EBOSS measurements from SDSS basically took us to the red contours, and then other measurements that have happened over the last decade, including Planck, took us through to these blue contours. So basically, we produced this plot just to show the impact of having this range of BAO and RSD measurements within Redshift and show how much it is useful and can be used to constrain what we know about cosmology. And this is the same thing, but now in terms of the individual parameters in this multi-parameter fit, showing that basically the posterior volume decreases by a factor of 40 when adding SDSS, BAO, and RSD measurements to what we knew in 2010. So I think this pretty convincingly shows that SDSS has had a huge impact in terms of cosmological knowledge over the last 10 years. And we get, you know, high precision measurements, dark energy density is particularly good, 0.7% precision under a lambda CDM non-flat model. We get 1% precision estimates of H0, sigma 8, pretty much regardless of however we vary the model away from flat lambda CDM. And in combination, we've got a dark energy task force figure of merit of 92, which is basically the end of stage 3 experiments and stage 4 experiments, which is the next generation, like DESI Euclid, will carry on from here. And you can find the standard tables of parameters and their constraints in this paper. Okay, so as well as these cosmological results, there are a number of papers released in the EBOS release looking at other things. One thing we can do is we can try and find strong lenses in SDSS data. This is not finding strong lenses using optical images, it's actually finding strong lenses using spectra. If you take a spectrum, you fit it with the best fit galaxy model, and then you subtract that model, and then you look for emission lines from background galaxies, you can try and find basically objects where you've got a spectra and there's two galaxies, one behind each other, that you can then use as a strong lens. This is one of the better ones where, having subtracted off the foreground galaxy light, you can see O2, H-beta, and O3. You can see three emission lines, including a doublet, from one of the background galaxies. So that catalog was made available in this paper. Another thing that people tried is, we do have this small patch of the sky where we have both LRGs, luminous red galaxies, and emission line galaxies. A group in China went away and tried to see if we could get this sample variance-free measurements of ratios within this region, where you look at two traces of the overdensity field, and then, if you know, counting how many troughs and peaks there are in that patch, they are traced by the same way in the galaxies. You can get, for example, the ratio of their biases in a way that doesn't depend how big the patch is. This was a little bit disappointing for EBOS. It wasn't a significant improvement. Just 18% on F sigma 8, and consequently, with the increased complexity of this analysis, we didn't include this in our standard baseline results. As I said before, the emission line galaxies are interested in the way in which they trace the halos. So we had one paper looking at the particular model, the HOD, that best fits the emission line galaxies, particularly how many of these galaxies are satellites versus centrals. That's presented in this paper. And finally, we had a preliminary analysis of voids that came out using voids to make Richter space distortion and Alcott-Pachinsky measurements. And that went away and did these. It used a pretty basic analysis. And one of the things we're looking at in the future is doing a more complicated and more precise measurement from voids. So a number of papers didn't make it in time, unfortunately, for the big announcement. Still to come are primordial non-Gaussianity measurements from the large-scale clustering of quasars. There is a draft in review at the moment. It will come out in 2.5 weeks' time, on Richter space distortion and Alcott-Pachinsky measurements in a slightly more complicated and in-depth methodology of looking at voids. There is a paper on small-scale Richter space distortion measurements that will come out in the future. And there are a number of cosmological tests. I, for example, don't really like the EG statistic, but there are other people in EBOS that do. And there's a draft in review at the moment on this. So that's it. That's my summary. If you're interested, particularly in the cosmology results, I'd strongly recommend you go away and look at these two web pages. This is something we didn't do in previous SDSS survey releases, and it's a really, really good thing to do. We have consolidated all of the measurements into two web pages. And then go away and read the archive, the 23 papers there. These are the archive numbers. All right, thank you. Questions?
All right, yeah, all right, thank you, Will. That was great. So yeah, any questions?
I have a question about the tightening of the cosmological constant lambda.
Yep.
As to much how much variation there is now in lambda, and specifically the measurements of W.
Ah.
So you seem to have tightened how much we can do with lambda beyond the standard constant.
Right. Yes, and again, I mean, this is basically coming down to this kind of plot, where now we have this standard ruler as a function of redshift, and it all agrees very consistently with flat lambda CDM. What this means is that expansion rate evolution looks like lambda CDM. So any W model that would predict more or less expansion just doesn't work. Rather like any model that would predict more or less expansion to change the low redshift H naught value doesn't work, because what we've got is a consistent series of points along the expansion rate between the CMB and low redshift that makes the expansion rate and the growth of structure within it look exactly like lambda CDM.
So it's looking more and more like the cosmological constant is the answer to dark energy. What about future experiments? How much tighter can we get that?
Well, DESI, for example, is on a 4-meter telescope with a 5,000 fiber multi-object spectrograph. So it's a factor of 20 times better than SDSS. So you can take these error bars and you can basically divide them by root 20, and that's what we will have in 5 years' time.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hey. So I had two questions. So first, so you showed this multi-tracer analysis.
Yeah.
I was just curious about like the samples that were used there. Were they like LRGs and ELGs?
Right. Yes, it's LRGs and ELGs. There is some redshift overlap, and there is some small overlap in area as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a reasonably small fraction of the total area and the total volume probed by each sample itself.
Right. So you mentioned that it was somewhat disappointing. So I was just wondering, what the origin of the disappointment?
Oh, it's disappointing in the sense that it's never going to go and really revolutionize our results just because we have this small overlap. Mm-hmm. And this was something, a compromise we had to do in the design way back like 7 years ago when we were setting up the experiment. And we wanted the ELGs to be the separate population and then to be efficiently observed by Sloan. They had to have a higher density, and that meant a smaller area. So we kind of knew that we were never going to really be a multi-tracer experiment. And it would have been nice to have been able to set up the experiment in a different way. And I guess that's my disappointment.
Oh, I see.
Not the fact that, given what we had, this was an unexpected result.
Okay. Okay. And my other question, I guess, was about your history plot. If you could show that again.
The BAO history or the...
Right. So you had some plot showing how Sloan has evolved over history and has improved our knowledge of specifically, I guess I was wondering about sigma 8. There was a claimed sigma 8 tension, and so has EBOS just killed that sigma 8 tension, I guess.
There was a claimed sigma 8 tension, which came pretty much from non-SDSS measurements of RSD. So a number of people have claimed that their growth rate measurements don't look like sigma 8 as expected from Lambda CDM. That was not using the SDSS RSD measurements. So these measurements, we don't think there's any evidence for them being different from Lambda CDM. And we think that the SDSS measurements are a consistent set of points that we've analyzed in a standardized way that give kind of robust constraints.
Right. But does it also rule out the low sigma eights that are seen from things like, you know, cosmic shear or, you know, Orson-Haseldovich clusters?
That's kind of like this plot. And it should be said that this weak lensing result that we plot here is the DES weak lensing, which is the one that was perhaps the most consistent with the CMB lensing results. So all of these data, at least, are, as far as we can tell, consistent with each other and consistent with this best fit solution from the CMB.
Well, people always talk about this like S8 tension.
Yeah, and that comes back. So we're not plotting here kids. Kids is slightly below this.
Oh, okay, right. But they do overlap with your contours. Is that what you're saying?
At the 2.5 sigma level, yeah, the kids do, yeah.
Okay.
The DES ones at the 1-2 sigma level.
Okay, great, thanks.
And I think that's also shown in this kind of plot here where you actually separate out the RSD and the weak lensing CMB lensing plots, and you're also always pulled back to Lambda CDM.
All right. Are there any further questions?
I have a question. So you didn't have time to talk much about the data analysis, obviously, but how much is there like room for like improved data analysis techniques? For example, did you experiment with different reconstruction techniques for the BAO? Like, is this standard reconstruction? Right. Did you try iterative one, things like that?
Yeah, there's always room for better data analysis techniques. One thing that we did better than had previously been done would be dealing with these fiber collisions. We did do reconstruction using the standard, basically Zeldovich style method. There are, if you believe the papers, better ways of doing that now available. So there's always
the numbers that you showed for the BAO reconstruction included already the standard Zeldovich, the standard reconstruction.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. Our BAO results included reconstruction. It's a possibility that you could maybe, you know, really prize out another 10% improvement by improving reconstruction. But I don't think you're not going to revolutionize results. You're never going to get better than, you know, like decreasing errors by 10%.
I haven't followed this in detail, but how about, you know, there was all these people who reanalyzed BOSS, right? Like the Senatora group was.
Right.
They got better results.
Models, fitting the full shape of the power spectrum. We're expecting those papers to come out in a matter of weeks by others, having made all of our catalogs and everything available. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, in general, although they get slightly more information, the BAO and the RSD measurements that we've made will dominate the information that comes out.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, if it sounds like maybe there's no further questions in that case, yeah, thanks again, Will, for a great talk.